Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Phil Dierking, John Russell, and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Phil Dierking.
Communities in the northern parts of the United States have used salt to keep icy roads safe during winter for many years. But some experts now say salt harms nearby freshwater supplies. Putting salt on icy roads helps reduce traffic accidents and prevents people from slipping and falling on roads and walkways. But researchers have found growing evidence that salt used on roads is increasing the salinity in many lakes in the U.S. Instead, they recommend using other materials such as beet juice, molasses, or even waste products from making beer or cheese. Victoria Kelly is a road salt expert at the Carey Institute of Ecosystem Studies in New York. She said scientists have been seeing increased amounts of salt in streams, rivers, and lakes. Now, she said, scientists are asking, what is going to happen to the organisms living in freshwater bodies, and what will happen to the freshwater bodies as a whole? Road salt is believed to have been first used in the 1940s in the state of New Hampshire. It became the main tool for removing ice from roads as cities expanded, highways were built, and drivers began expecting clear roads. It is estimated that more than 20 million tons of salt are used each winter in places like the northeastern and midwestern United States. But many state and local agencies are looking for ways to reduce salt use because its harmful effects on the environment are becoming clearer. Some agencies now use high-technology equipment to spread salt more effectively. Others are trying to study weather reports to make better decisions about when to use salt. Another new tool is liquid organic products that help salt stick to roads so it does not wash away easily. For example, agencies in states such as New Jersey and North Dakota are using a mixture that includes beet juice to keep ice off of roads. New Hampshire and Maine use molasses. Highway departments also have used beer waste and pickle brine. In at least one county in Wisconsin, cheese brine was used. Jonathan Rubin is director of the Margaret Chase Smith Policy Center in Maine. He is the lead author of a 2010 report on salting roads in the state. Adding salt to the environment does have negative impacts, but for those of us in the Northeast, especially in rural states, where driving is the predominant way of getting around, we need mobility, said Rubin. In my opinion, we are always going to be using some degree of road salt, he said. The question is, can we use less? Experts say salt corrosion already causes billions of dollars in damage each year to cars, roads, and bridges. They also say there are growing signs that road salt is getting into freshwater. In the past 50 years, chloride levels in some lakes and rivers are 4 times higher than normal. In a few cases, they are 100 times higher. Last year, a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that more than 40% of the lakes studied showed long-term salinization. The researchers estimated that by 2050, nearly 50 lakes in the study will have chloride levels that threaten freshwater plants and animals. Other studies have shown that salinization of lakes and streams reduces the number of fish and amphibians and kills plants. Caleb Dobbins is New Hampshire's highway maintenance engineer. Although there are concerns, he does not think salt will be replaced anytime soon. Other chemicals, he notes, are more expensive than salt and have their own environmental risks. I'm Phil Dierking.
From VOA Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. Today, we will take a look at the modal verbs could have, would have, and should have. These past tense modals are useful for expressing your present feelings about a past decision or other action. Could have, would have, and should have are sometimes called modals of lost opportunities. They work like a grammatical time machine. The simple past just tells what happened. Past modals tell what could have, would have, and should have happened. To form these past modals, use could, would, or should, followed by have, followed by a past participle verb. Use have for all pronouns. Never use has or had to form a past modal. Here are some examples.
She could have gone to any college she wanted to. I would have gone to the party, but I was tired. He should have told the truth about what he saw.
Each of these modals has a slightly different meaning. We'll look at each of them using examples from movies and popular songs.
We'll start with could have. Could have means that something was possible in the past, but it did not happen.
I could have gone directly to college, but I decided to travel for a year.
Listen to this song by 1980s teen pop star Tiffany. The singer is thinking about past possibilities with her lost love. Native speakers often do not pronounce their past tense modals as clearly as Tiffany. Could have been usually gets contracted to could have been or even could have been. Listen to Marlon Brando in the classic film On the Waterfront. Brando's character, Terry Molloy, was once a promising young boxer.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum.
To form the negative with these modals, use not between could and have. Could not have means that something was impossible in the past. For example,
She could not have been on that flight because I just saw her at work.
Defense lawyers often use could not have to argue for a client's innocence. A popular compliment in English is,
I couldn't have said it better myself.
You can say this when you like the way somebody said something. It is a way to show strong agreement.
Let's move on to would have. Would have is a bit more difficult because it has two common structures. The first is with but. I would have A, but I had to B. Use this structure to show that you wanted to do something in the past, but you could not.
I would have called, but there was no phone service. I would have loaned you the money, but I didn't have any.
Would have also forms the result clause of a past unreal conditional. For example,
if I had known they were vegetarians, I would have made a salad.
You can always reverse conditional sentences. If would have comes first, there is no comma.
I would have made a salad if I had known they were vegetarians.
Past unreal conditionals are very complex. You can learn more about them on a previous episode of Everyday Grammar. Usually, would have suggests a bad feeling about the past, but not always. In this song by the band Chicago, the singer is surprisingly happy that his ex-girlfriend cheated on him. Her infidelity gave him the opportunity to meet someone else, and that someone else turned out to be his true love.
Finally, let's look at should have. Should have means that something did not happen, but we wish it had happened. We use should have to talk about past mistakes. A worried mother might say,
I was so worried about you. You should have called.
Should have is common in apologies. For example,
I'm sorry that I'm late for work. I should have woken up earlier.
You might remember Lieutenant Dan in the movie Forrest Gump. In the movie, Dan loses both of his legs in the Vietnam War. He would have died, but Forrest saved him. Listen for should have as Dan confronts Forrest.
You listen to me. We all have a destiny. Nothing just happens. It's all part of a plan. I should have died out there with my men, but now I'm nothing but a cripple.
Should have can be used in a lighthearted way. In this song, country singer Toby Keith imagines how exciting his life would be if he had chosen to be a cowboy.
I should have been a cowboy. I should have learned to rope and ride. Wearing my six-shooter, riding my pony on a cattle drive.
I couldn't have said it better myself. As you can see, these modals of lost opportunities offer a colorful way to talk about past choices. That's all for this week. Join us next week for more Everyday Grammar. I'm John Russell.
And I'm Dr. Jill Robbins.
I should have been a cowboy. I should have learned to rope and ride.
¶¶ from VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The 1850s were an increasingly tense time in the United States. Most of the population lived east of the Mississippi River, but more and more people were moving west. As western areas became populated, they became official territories and then new states. The settlement of these areas once again raised the issue of slavery. A law passed in 1820 called the Missouri Compromise extended a line across the map of the United States. Slavery was legal in areas south of the line. North of the line, slavery was illegal except in the state of Missouri. 30 years later, another political compromise made slavery a local issue instead of a national one. The Compromise of 1850 said people in the Western territories could decide for themselves whether slavery would be legal or illegal. Then, in 1854, Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas proposed another measure. His legislation would also affect slavery. It aimed to make the wild western area known as Nebraska an official territory.
This is the Great Plains. This is open territory. There were Indian tribes settled out there.
Nicole Etchison is an historian. She says white settlers could not move to Nebraska because a government did not yet exist there. They wanted the U.S. Congress to open the area to settlers. Investors wanted Congress to act, too, so Nebraska could support a railroad. Nebraska lies north of the line drawn by the Missouri Compromise of 1820. As a result, slavery would be banned in the territory, but slavery was permitted in the state next to Nebraska, Missouri. Slaveholders in Missouri did not want Nebraska to become a free territory. They were afraid their slaves would flee to it. They felt threatened by the free states and territories around them. So Senator Douglas proposed that the large Nebraska area be split in two. The northern part would be known as the Nebraska Territory. The southern part, next to Missouri, would be known as the Kansas Territory. The senator said that settlers in both territories had the right to decide whether their lands would accept slavery. He argued that the Compromise of 1850 had given the same right to people in two other territories, New Mexico and Utah. And he claimed that same right was meant for the people of all future territories. Douglas noted that in the past, the federal government sought to divide free states from slave states by making a line across a map. He said, dividing up land was not the answer. He said the people in a state or territory had the right to decide for themselves. This right was known as popular sovereignty. Historian Nicole Etchison says popular sovereignty required faith in the American political process.
Stephen Douglas argued that the foundation of American political philosophy is that the people get to decide, the voters get to decide issues, and there was no reason why they couldn't decide the slavery issue, just like they decided any other political issue.
Douglas argued that the Compromise of 1850 took the place of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The new Kansas-Nebraska Act, he said, simply recognized the fact that the Missouri Compromise was dead. a number of anti-slavery senators denounced the Kansas-Nebraska bill. They said it was part of a Southern plan to spread slavery wherever possible. They also said Stephen Douglas was using the measure for political purposes. They said he wanted to be president and was hoping to influence voters in southern states. Opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska bill was extremely strong in the northern states. In city after city, large public gatherings were held. Businessmen organized many of the meetings. They were angry at Douglas because he had reopened the dispute about slavery. They feared that the dispute would hurt the nation's economy. Northern religious leaders also united against the bill. Thousands signed protests and sent them to Congress. Douglas criticized the clergymen. He said they should stay out of politics. In the southern United States, the Kansas-Nebraska Act caused little excitement. Most southerners were not interested in it. They believed the measure might help the cause of slavery, but they also believed it might lead to trouble. President Franklin Pierce did not like the bill. He feared it would reopen the bitter national debate about slavery. However, most members of the U.S. Senate supported the Kansas-Nebraska bill. It passed easily in the Senate. The bill had less support in the House of Representatives. The vote there was close, but the measure passed. President Pierce finally agreed to sign it into law. In exchange, congressional leaders promised to approve several presidential appointments. Supporters of the Kansas-Nebraska Act celebrated its passage. They fired cannons as the city of Washington was waking to a new day. Two senators who opposed the bill heard the noise as they walked down the steps of the Capitol building. One of them said, "They celebrate a victory now, but the echoes they awake will never rest until slavery itself is dead." The new law gave the people of Kansas and Nebraska the right to decide if slavery would be legal or illegal. The vote would depend on who settled in the territories. It was not likely that people who owned slaves would settle in Nebraska. However, there was a good chance slave owners would settle in Kansas. Groups in the South organized quickly to help pro-slavery settlers move to Kansas. At the same time, groups in the North helped free state settlers move to Kansas. Historian Nicole Etchison says some of these settlers were abolitionists who believed slavery was wrong, but many were simply white farmers looking for new lands to settle. Ms. Etchison says these farmers did not care about slavery, but they did not want to live near blacks or compete with slave labor.
It's that third group of Midwesterners who becomes crucial, because when they get out there to Kansas and they can't get a fair vote, they become radicalized against slavery.
In Washington, President Pierce appointed Andrew Reeder as governor of the Kansas Territory. Pro-slavery settlers urged Reeder to hold immediate elections for a territorial legislature. They believed they were in the majority. They wanted a vote before too many free state settlers moved in. Governor Reeder rejected the demands. He decided to hold an election, but only for a territorial representative to the National Congress. On Election Day, hundreds of men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. They voted illegally, and the pro-slavery candidate won. The same thing happened when Kansas finally held an election for a legislature. Once again, men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. Many of them carried guns. They forced election officials to count their illegal votes. As a result, almost every pro-slavery candidate was elected to the new legislature. Nicole Etchison says many American elections in the 1800s had examples of violence, bad behavior, and wrongdoing. But the pro-slavery Missourians were extreme.
It was obvious that there was egregious fraud in the elections in Kansas Territory.
She says population counts at the time showed fewer than 3,000 voters in Kansas Territory. But pro-slavery candidates received up to 6,000 votes. The governor ordered an investigation. The investigation showed evidence of wrongdoing in six areas. New elections were held in those areas. This time, when only legal votes were counted, many of the pro-slavery candidates were defeated. Yet there were still enough pro-slavery candidates to hold a majority. Andrew Reeder understood he was governing a bitterly divided territory. He wanted to warn President Pierce about what was happening. So Reeder went to Washington. He met with Pierce almost every day for 2 weeks. He described how pro-slavery groups in Missouri were interfering in Kansas. He said if the state of Missouri refused to deal with the troublemakers, then the national government must deal with them. He asked the president to do something. Pierce agreed that Kansas was a serious problem. He seemed ready to act. Reeder returned home and opened the first meeting of the territorial legislature. The pro-slavery majority quickly voted to move to a town close to the Missouri border. It also approved several pro-slavery measures. Governor Reeder vetoed these bills, but the legislature rejected his veto and passed the new laws. The Kansas legislature also sent a message to President Pierce. It wanted him to remove Reeder as governor. Political pressure was strong, and the president agreed. He named a new governor, Wilson Shannon. Shannon supported the pro-slavery laws of the legislature. He also said Kansas should become a slave state like Missouri. Kansas settlers, who had voted against slavery, became extremely angry. Soon, the situation became violent. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.